Good morning, Chair.
Finance and Revenue Committee is open. Today, we're going to look at stable funding. We have a couple presentations to go through on this day of, we're going to look at the Swiss Alps of Oregon, and more on that in a minute. First, I did want to announce on the issue of central assessment, those LCs that we looked at the other day, yesterday. We will have amendments to what have become bills now probably by Friday, and a hearing on Monday, possible work session on Monday on those on that legislation, which will be at least one bill will be compiled into one bill for the whole enchilada, as we're calling it. All right?
Doesn't mean we're going to agree. It just means it's a great idea.
Yeah.
I've been in the legislature 14 years, and every year I've been on the House Revenue Committee or the Senate Revenue Committee, and every year this issue of reforming our tax code and reducing our volatility comes up, and every year it seems like it gets to be a more difficult problem to tackle, and as has been noted here many, many times, Oregon has the most volatile tax code in the country. As a result, simply that we are so reliant on the personal income tax. So I have a slide deck here to help sort of illustrate this and at least show the committee why this is important to me and others. We could switch that over now if you want. But when I go around my community in Beaverton and talk to people about it, it's easy to see guys' eyeballs glaze over, and all of a sudden we're talking about diverse tax base or economic phrases, elasticity. But let me just give you a little case study of what happened in my community a few years ago in Beaverton. Right after the recession hit, we had 400 teachers that were laid off, and this was quite a blow. And since then, about 300-350 have been added back, and I don't mean those are the same people. These are 300 positions that have been added back, and therein lies one of the tragedies that many of those teachers who were let go and laid off are no longer teachers. And we have a friend of ours who's told us her life's calling was to be a teacher, and but she's been laid off twice now, and she said, I didn't sign up for these budget issues, and she took her CPA test and now she's an accountant. So we lost that person. More importantly, the effect that this had on our community, and similar stories all over the state, was the effect it had on our schools, that schools' classroom sizes almost doubled from 20s into the 40s. And that has a huge impact on parents and on teachers, and most importantly, the students and their ability to learn. We had hundreds of emails, I'm sure you all did too, on this dynamic of bumping, where all of a sudden, as a result of those layoffs, the teachers that stayed were now being transferred from high school physical education classes to teaching kindergarten or first grade. And that was very upsetting. And what all of this did was it killed our mojo in our community, where people would come to town halls and go, why are things so bad? How come we just can't seem to do this? And it has a psychological effect on communities that you cannot quantify on a balance sheet, and it has a bad effect on our mojo. And I think reversing this process, fixing our tax code so that we don't have to go through those boom and bust cycles will have the opposite effect. And just so we're straight here, I just want to make sure I remind everybody that this is where the money goes. When I talk to at town halls like I did last week, is to remind everyone that more than half of the state budget in the general fund goes to education, and that this discussion here is not about spending. And lots of times I'm interrupted by people who say, look, if you just spent your money more wisely, you wouldn't have to deal with this. Our general fund budget is $17 or $18 billion. There are people who think it should be $27 billion. There are people who think it should be $10 billion. whatever the amount is, what we're discussing here on this issue is what's the most efficient, sensible way to raise whatever we need, whether it's $10 billion or $20 billion. Everyone agrees at some level that we need schools, prisons, state police, and so forth. So what's the most efficient and rational way to raise that amount of money that syncs up with Oregon's economy, that provides enough money for schools and universities and community colleges and all of those other things? And as we've said here on this committee many, many times, if you think of it in this way, if Oregon became a state after a territory and it's now an official state, and yesterday and today we have to write up a new tax code, would we write a tax code that is what we have now? And the answer, of course, I think everybody can agree, is no. Here's the definition, something that changes in a very sudden or extreme way, and that's our tax system. This is from the Legislative Revenue Office. You can see that 69% of everything that comes into our general fund is from the personal income tax. Other fees, selective sales taxes, the corporate income tax at 5%, and of course, Oregon has no sales tax. More than half of the states in the country do have some sort of an income tax. The average is about 37%. Oregon is about double that average, almost. This is my favorite graph that best illustrates the ups and downs, the general fund revenues going back, I think, about 15 or 16 years. And when I look at this graph, I sort of start thinking of the Swiss Alps, because that's what it reminds me. And Dr. Warner recently commented that if I was to be geologically accurate, I should probably put the Grand Canyon down there in the 2009 figure when we dropped 45% and had to cut budgets by $3 billion. This is what we want. Instead of Swiss Alps, we need rolling hills. So our revenue stream grows like that along the lines of our economy. It's another way to look at those dips and valleys. Oregon, as I mentioned, is the most volatile state. Number two, historically, has been Washington, our neighbors to the north, which doesn't have an income tax and is very dependent upon the sales tax. But there's another example of how an income tax volatility compares with the corporate tax and the sales tax. But when you look at Washington's volatile tax code, even Washington doesn't have the highs and the lows as Oregon when you measure it as a change from each biennium. We'll get into the kicker a little bit later, but this is definitely something that has probably outlived its usefulness or could be improved upon and put into a rainy day fund. It requires a statewide vote to change. $2.5 billion have been refunded since the inception of the kicker law change. When you adjust our revenue stream for the kicker, you can see the effect there, that it takes out some of the highs. And that's generally a good thing. But if you notice, it certainly doesn't take out the lows, because while the kicker arranges for tax rebates when revenues come in over the forecast, there is no opposite mechanism for what happens when they come in too low or below a forecast. From the Legislative Revenue Office, you can see Oregon is because of its volatility, one of the hardest hit states by the recent recession. Alaska, very hard hit, but you can't even really compare things to Alaska because of their oil revenues and the fact that they have a $20 billion reserve fund. So when I talk to people in my community at town halls, they generally fall into one of these categories taxes, taxation, tax codes, changes in taxes tend to leave people lost, disoriented, confused. They're looking at their own picture and nothing seems to make sense. And therein lies a huge problem here in terms of getting everybody on the same page. And it only takes one argument out of 1,000 moving parts in a tax overhaul to make someone confused. And you could write a radio ad around one of those moving parts, and sometimes that happens. But this is a hard problem, and it's one that can possibly be a one by education and engagement outreach. And I'm hoping to do that in part in this committee as we look for ways to make more sense out of our tax code now. When I do my little surveys as a state senator, I often, this is always the most popular option when we look at solutions, going after the rich. This is also usually number two, going after the big faceless corporations. And this is also an option, that we just make some small changes over time and eventually get there rather than the big massive overhaul. So we're working. We're kicking off things with a work group that we have of an informal group of legislators. We met again last night. Senator Boquist is on that team. And we're trying to go forward with something that in the end doesn't leave us with a feeling of being... My slideshow that I use on the road a little bit, and thanks for indulging me. I hope that clears up any confusion, Senator Riley.
I think it was a great presentation.
Thank you.
I think it's more of a TED Talk.
A TED Talk.
You need a little earpiece mic, you know, and walk around in the audience. So in the sequel, do we get to see what happened to the car?
Mr. Chair,
it goes off the cliff with the bill. and the legislator who sponsored in the seat.
Before the state became solely, not solely, but very much involved in funding the schools, the counties, the monies used to come from the counties, and could we somehow get a presentation and roll back the clock a few decades and just see what that model looks like? Because I have no idea what that model. Yeah. So it'd be nice to understand that other model. Not saying we're going back to it, but it'd be nice to understand that model so as we go forward in looking at this, because I completely agree with you. It's not how much money is. It's when and if it comes is the problem.
Right. Well, I think that's a good segue into Dr. Warner's slightly more subdued and economist approach to this issue. We have some people who have come also to weigh in on this. So let's start with Dr. Warner's presentation and your team.
Okay.
Good thing I didn't bring my nails, huh? Okay, technology looks like it's failed us there. We legislators push buttons all the time.
Hey, MPC, pre-computer.
Yeah, MPC, before computers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. Just a comment from about Senator Bertschinger's comment about the pre-Measure 5 era. We do have, if you thumb through some of the pages in our basic facts, we have a couple of things. One is showing how we went from a a very high property tax state relative to other states, ranked fifth in the nation on a per capita basis. Until now, since 5 and 50 fully phased in, we're about average. So we went from a high property tax state to an average property tax state. And the other chart we have in there, we've got the school operating sources of revenue going back to 1947 and looking how that's changed over time. And, of course, you really see, again, the 50 phase in where we went from about 30% funded by the state. There was a basic school support program, as it was called then, and became the state's school fund after that. And now we're in the two-thirds, 65 to 70% range. We tend to go to up to 70% in the good times and down to 65 in the not-so-good times that Senator Haas was showing in that when the general fund is down. But what I'd like to do is just kind of go through, actually, some of the material here is in the basic facts, give you a sense of the overall structure of the tax system, talk a bit about some of the things that have been suggested or looked at as potential approaches to restructuring the tax system. I would say one thing about some of the material in your OLIS meeting material. You have a letter in there from the Netherlands and from the Swiss embassy. This isn't a reference to Senator Haas's Swiss Alps chart, but it's a reference to our tax haven report that you'll get next week, so in case that causes any confusion. The overall revenue structure, these are census data. The 11-12 census data came out. Every 5 years, there's a census of government, and then in the interim years, they estimate what revenue is for the state. So this is the most comprehensive look we'll get. Just came out just before Christmas, so this is a very recent data. And you can see that the census categorizes major state and local revenue sources into four categories: taxes, federal charges, and miscellaneous. Charges, by far the biggest component there is tuition, higher ed charges. Health charges are the second biggest. Miscellaneous does include lottery revenue is in there. That's where we tend to be above average there, but now we're right about at average. A couple of things to keep in mind. We are less dependent on taxes as a general revenue source than just about any other state. We're in the bottom five in terms of the percentage of revenue we raise from taxes. You can see that we're relatively high in federal revenue, which you could argue that's probably not a good position to be in as we look to the next 10 or 15 years in terms of what federal policy is likely to do. This is federal revenue going to state and local governments. It's not Social Security or something going to individuals. Charges, we have tend to rely on that. And clearly, I think one of the strategies in response to Measure 5, a conscious strategy, was to move to more of a fee-based budget. Obviously, it occurred in higher ed with tuition. So if you look at that breakdown, you can see that our revenue on a per capita basis is below what the national average is by about $175 per person. So multiply that by 4 million to get the dollar amounts. And again, we're much less reliant on taxes than a typical state system. If you look at just our taxes, this is state and local. The chair showed you a chart showing state, and I'll look at that too. But this is state and local, so you can see where property taxes. Again, property taxes now, if we look at property taxes on a per capita basis, they're a little below average. At a percent of income, they're just about at average. So again, we've become an average property tax state, and that was really the lasting effect of those property tax initiatives. Personal income, again, is double the U.S. average as a percent of income. And of course, we don't have a general sales tax, one of five states that don't. Our corporate has tended to be right around average as well. Our selective sales taxes have gone up relative to other states, though we're still below average, primarily because we picked up the provider taxes in that category, the hospital provider taxes that you've used for the Oregon Health Authority in the last few sessions. But if you look at the tax burden as a percent of income, we're at 10.1% compared to 10.5% for the country as a whole.
Where does that rank us?
That ranks us 29th. So this is the chart that Senator Haas showed you. This is the 68%. This is state now. This is state taxes, total state taxes. So this would include, you know, gas tax and selective taxes in there, some things that we refer to as other funds in our budgeting process. And here's looking at the numbers behind that and compared some of our Western neighbors. You can see that Washington's 59.6, we point out, is high. That's the second most concentrated revenue If you look at just a single source being the highest percentage of the total, Washington's second most concentrated. We are the most concentrated, not only the most reliant on the income tax, but the most reliant on a single tax.
Senator Butcher.
Were these figures, did they come out before California raised theirs to 13%?
These, I think they picked up some of that increase, probably not a full year. These are 12, 13. We're able to move forward a year because it's state only, and they come out with that data a little earlier. So my guess is, given the lags in the income tax, they probably pick up some of it, but not all of that increase. And I think 13, 14 would pick up all of that. And, of course, you know, the other thing you see in these kinds of tables is if you look at income taxes versus sales taxes over the course of a business cycle, the income taxes actually go down relative to sales taxes because the sales taxes are a lot more stable in a recession, and then they go up during an expansion. If you look typically, it's pretty close to equal across the country, income taxes versus sales taxes. I mean, as a percent of total tax collections. Surprisingly, in this data, if we look at the West, the pace setter in terms of a balanced revenue system is Idaho. Almost a perfectly balanced property tax state system, and their property taxes, by the way, are very close to what they raise from a personal and general sales tax. So those three revenue sources are almost equal in the Idaho system. This is the measure 550. Kyle will talk a little bit with you about some of the options around property tax reform. This, of course, is the change of going away from a market value-based system to the Measure 50 system with a separate calculation for assessed value. One of the things that the consequences of this shift was it did create more stability, and you can clearly see that in the housing boom and bust, which a lot of states went through. On the other hand, it really puts the local governments and those reliant on the property tax into a slow growth revenue source. And the biggest concern there is not being responsive to growth and being able to meet the needs of growth. So, you know, a property tax dominated local system kind of has the opposite problems that the state system has. Slow growing but stable, where the state grows over time but it's very unstable. So then to move into the discussion around tax reform and what are some of the criteria, how do we evaluate the current system and some of the possible approaches. And then I'll finish with a couple of things around consumption taxes, because that obviously is the big hole in the system if you want to diversify. But there are other options as well that may move you in the direction you want to go. These are the kinds of things we look at. I mean, these criteria go back to the 1950s. Richard Musgrave was the one who sold many public finance textbooks, and this was his basic criteria for evaluating taxes. It's always important to keep in mind, I know it's an obvious point, but the key reason why we have taxes is to pay for public services. I mean, they're a cost, and if you look at them in isolation, they're going to have a negative effect on the economy because they're extracting resources out of the economy. So you have to look at that in the context of what they're buying. So that's always that it's easy to lose sight of that sometimes around the discussion about taxes. Equity is, if you talk to anybody, and I'm sure you hear it on the floor of the Senate, that why are you opposed to this tax? Well, it's not fair. And that's, you know, the equity issue is what really rings true with people. And we do have some criteria for looking at equity, both vertical equity, ability to pay, and also horizontal equity, which we would argue is a big problem with the current property tax system. We have equals in the property tax system treated much differently because of their assessed value ratios. Still, it's kind of the system that the public wants to have. The economic impact, we've continued to work on our tools to look at that. We're in the process of updating our Oregon tax incidence model that allows us to look at big changes in the system. So, for example, if you were to go to consumption tax, we can estimate what the effects would be on employment, what the effects would be on the distribution of the tax burden. And then, of course, administration is always critical. And you're seeing that, for example, that issue's come up with the central assessment ideas you're looking at. So evaluation, these are the kinds of things we would emphasize are the strengths of our current system versus the weaknesses. our system is, and here's the chance to use our elasticity term here, the personal income tax is elastic with respect to income. It grows more rapidly. It is elasticity of greater than one, meaning its percent change is greater than the percent change in income. That's fine over time because the economy tends to grow. But in those periods when it declines, it means the declines are bigger in percentage terms. The personal income tax is, the beauty of the personal income tax is that, I mentioned that equity is the primary concern that, that most people have about taxes. Personal income tax is the most flexible form to deal with it because you can target credits or you can target the things you want to allow deductions on. It's a very flexible system. You can adjust the tax rates. So it gives you as policymakers the tools to adjust the equity concerns you have. Now, the trade-off when that, if you do too much of that, is you end up like the federal system is now, where it becomes extremely complicated. You may end up doing things that, that aren't intended. And it is an advantage for us. Sometimes it's a disadvantage in terms of your stability policy, but in terms of administration, in terms of being able to use IRS audits and some of their data and information and for taxpayers to know they've got two systems that, that are the same, it makes administration easier. Now, on the weakness side, when you have an unbalanced system, and you have to rely on relatively high marginal income tax rates, you're going to have more of a tendency to distort economic decisions. And that's any economic model would tell you that, that it's the decisions at the margin that matter. So with high marginal rates, you affect the take-home pay or the after-tax return on capital, and you distort those decisions. The reliance on the income tax is unstable, and I'll show you some numbers on that in a minute. And there's another element here that's related but is separate, and that's through the lack of diversity. If you think about a portfolio, the more balanced your portfolio is, the less the overall variability of the total portfolio. Even if the individual assets within that portfolio have a lot of instability, as long as they're not perfectly correlated with one another, you get more stability from diversifying. You know, whenever you watch the financial news and the market's going down, that's what all the experts say. Well, you need to diversify. And that's same is true in terms of your tax portfolio for stability. The property tax system has basically become almost beyond your ability to make significant changes to its structure because it's all embedded in the Constitution. So if you're looking at major changes, it inevitably is constitutional. And then, as I mentioned, and we've done a lot of work on this, and certainly this committee has done a lot of work on this over the last few years, is the degree of variability you have, where you may have two properties, two residences that have about the same market value but have much different assessment ratios. So they're paying a lot different taxes, even though the value of the property is about the same. So approaches to reform, and these are the things that the work group has begun to look at. One thing, and I think you could argue that we've seen some of this, is to shift the base from income to consumption. And if you look going back to the Measure 5 and the advent of Measure 5 in 91, one of the big changes was going to lottery, which is not a tax, but it's certainly a restructuring of the revenue system toward consumption. Even the shift toward a fee-based system we've seen is partially a shift. And in fact, even I would argue that the change in your apportionment formula to a single sales factor, in theory, a single sales factor is like a consumption tax because you're allocating corporate income based on market sales or consumption. So we've seen some shifts like that, nothing dramatic, but that those are things that have occurred over time, and you see it in the numbers. Another option would be to change the structure of your income tax to broaden it. Right now, we are connected to federal taxable income. And Christine will talk about this a little bit, to go from a connection at the taxable point to the adjusted gross income point, where you'd basically not accept the federal deductions that are in the system. And that would take out a lot of your tax expenditures, would give the state a lot more control over what those deductions will be, and potentially allow you to lower rates and raise more revenue or the same amount of revenue.
Senator Boquist?
So just for the viewing audience, nobody in the room here, what we're really talking about in broadening income tax base and lowering rates is a flat tax concept, sort of a flat tax concept. Is that right?
It could involve flattening the rates, yes. One of the things, even if you have a perfectly flat rate, you just have a single rate, you could still make it progressive because you could establish a large standard deduction,
right,
which in effect is a zero amount. So in most all cases, you're talking about at minimum two rates, a zero rate and some positive rate. But yeah, but it wouldn't have to necessarily be that way. I mean, you could broaden this base and maybe consolidate the rates and other adjustments. Again, the income tax is very flexible, and you could adjust it the way you think. Another option is to, and you know, all of these, of course, could be looked at potentially as complementary. But another option is to say, well, given the revenue system the way it is now, very difficult to make fundamental changes to it. We know it's highly cyclical. Develop a strong reserve fund policy to deal with that instability. And oftentimes this involves looking at the kicker, and we've got some issues around that this session as well. But you have made significant changes over the last 15 years, the Education Stability Fund, the Rainy Day Fund that were established. And then finally, the one that we have seen historically through a sales tax, but it doesn't have to be a sales tax. A major consumption tax can be, we generally think of four different approaches. One is the traditional U.S. retail sales tax, which tends to have a fairly narrow base, a base that is shrinking relative to income. Washington's has really shrunk over the last 20 years relative to their income. It could be a broader sales tax, including a lot of services, which typically are not taxed within the traditional retail sales tax base. It could be a gross receipts base, something like the business and occupation tax, or a tax that we've been looking at quite a bit lately is the CAT, commercial activity tax in Ohio, which is a gross receipts-based, destination-based tax.
Paul, one quick question on that sales tax question. What's the status of internet sales?
Internet sales, the states, of course, the sales tax states have been very concerned about internet sales eroding their base over time. They have set up an arrangement called the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement. What they would really like to have would be some federal legislation. There was some federal legislation that passed the Senate in 13, I think, but did not pass the House. So there hasn't been any adopted federal law changes. But what they've done is set up a system where the biggest argument in the Quill case against taxing remote sales was that state and local systems are so varied. They're what they consider exemptions, and it's too complicated to expect a remote seller to comply with all of these different systems. So the streamlined sales tax system has been designed to try to create common definitions for exemptions and to reduce the amount of variation. And so they've gotten some of the bigger companies to volunteer to work with them, especially those companies that both do remote sales and have brick and mortar, because they're affected both ways. They can be affected adversely by remote sellers because they're competing with them in those states where they're paying sales tax and the remote seller isn't. So there's been some progress, but probably not to get to the point of a solution until you get federal legislation.
As a follow-up, that, I mean, this is an intriguing area, but I mean, I know of some individuals, you know, that, I mean, it's tax month, right, January, that, you know, buy and sell, you know, on the side some of their games and stuff like that on eBay, and this year is the first time I've ever heard or seen it, they're getting 1099s.
Yeah.
Now, does the state get a copy of the 1099? I mean, and for those who don't know what 1099 is, this is a gross value, you know. So you've got somebody that did $1,000 worth of trading on eBay. eBay is now issuing a 1099 that's going to the IRS. Now, is this part of this new movement afoot? Is it only eBay? Because now suddenly if the state's getting it, you know that, you know, Bob Smith got $10,000 in business off of eBay, for example. Now, of course, that could be capital gains, could be all kinds of things. But it is... Where are we going? Because let's face reality. I mean, I have no idea what the Federalists are going to do, but, you know, if it didn't come out last time, I don't see the present Congress doing much of anything to resolve this issue, so.
Bob Smith did that, the former congressman?
Absolutely. I'll throw him under the bus, not my district.
So, the answer is yes, I think it's related, but that's really an income tax issue. But the sales tax states want to make sure they can apply sales taxes to sales that occur in their state. So they're looking for, they see it as a destination-based tax, so that if it's sold into the state, they want to be able to tax that transaction. Whereas I think the 1099s are tied back to gross income. And so that if you get this gross income, that should be reported on your income tax return. So it's related, but the income tax and not the sales tax. Okay, so if you look at the consumption tax approach, and as I say, there's a number. The other one I didn't mention was the value-added tax, which some of you remember we worked with a lot in the 01 session. Chair Shetterly at the time called it the BAT, the business activity tax, which was based on value-added. And the Governor Schwarzenegger, before he left office in California, had a commission, that Tax Reform Commission, and they recommended some type of value-added tax. The concern I think most people have had with that is that it's pretty rare in the U.S. The only state that actually operates one now is New Hampshire, that has what they call the BET, which is a business enterprise tax, which is similar, but that's kind of an odd tax system with no sales or income tax. These are some of the advantages and disadvantages. We would argue that would be the case of making, for example, an unequal shift from an income-based system to consumption-based. Our models show there would be positive long-term economic growth because a consumption tax is generally less of a deterrent to economic growth. It doesn't directly affect rate of return to capital or to labor. It's more stable. And it does expand to include some of the bases. I did do a little bit of work. I asked a question we've been asked a lot about the underground economy, and there was a study done looking at all the states, and we applied some of the percentage. I actually did an estimate for what Oregon was, and their estimate for underground activity and a sales tax, what would be collected, was about 7.4% of the total base. So that would, for a 5% sales tax, that would result in about $125 million a year. It would come from that base that's not currently being taxed. The challenges, if you go to a consumption tax, your system's going to look more like the rest of the country. And if you compare the distribution of the tax burden in Oregon, it's generally close to unitary. The tax burden by income class is roughly flat, whereas most states are very relative regressive, especially Washington, for example. There's some regressivity in the Oregon system depending on your assumptions, but compared to other states is much less so. Going to a consumption tax would move you in that direction. A lower long-term revenue growth, lower elasticity over time, that's part of the trade-off of the volatility. And any time, no matter how bad your tax system is, if you make big changes, then it's going to create disruptions because people have based their decisions on that old system. You see more retail activity in Oregon than the size of the economy would suggest. Well, that's not hard to figure out why, not only at the Washington border, but also the Idaho border. Some of the underlying data for one of the charts the chair had about showing growth and stability for state tax revenue sources. This looks at the average growth. This is year-over-year growth quarterly. It goes back to 2001 through the first half of 2014. You can see that the income tax growth rate on average is about 3%, which is about what the total is. This is relatively low because you're including two major recessions in this time period. The standard deviation for the personal income tax, you can see, is more than double what it is for the sales tax, about 9.5% compared to 4.4. And you can see this is the maximum decline. This was actually the second quarter of 2009 compared to the second quarter of 2008, the depth of the Great Recession. It was down 27%. Corporate was down 34%. Sales tax, slower growth, less volatility, lower standard deviation. Overall total standard deviation is quite a bit less than the components, a little bit more than sales tax, but you would definitely get benefits from diversifying this, your revenue stream. This is the chart the chair had, but showing Washington and Oregon. Obviously, the Washington system more stable than Oregon. We're going to go up and down more. The two negatives we had here in 01, 03 and 07, 09, those are the first two negative biennia we've had in revenue since the Depression, since the Great Depression. Not the Great Recession, the Great Depression in the 30s. And here's the projection. And, of course, the projections are made, not being critical because I've made a lot of these projections myself, they tend to be based on trend. And we know if you go out to 17, 19, you're likely to see a recession in that period. These are the deviations on the forecast. So you can see that when you get a forecast, you can see the potential of the historical deviation in that forecast. So again, in those recessions like 01, 03, we hadn't experienced anything of that magnitude for decades, and you can see the forecast was off by 15%. The Great Recession was spread over two biennia, so you can see a 10% error and then a 7%. So that gives you kind of an idea of the magnitude of what you're looking at. When you look at that close of session estimate, there's a lot of variability, and that has to do with the unpredictability of our revenue stream. The primary culprits for that instability are the subcomponents. Corporate income tax varies a lot. And the other one is the major area of volatility within the personal income tax is the capital gains income taxes collected based on capital gains. That's due to the variability in the stock market, where most of those capital gains come from over time, and the fact that they're at the discretion of the owner of the asset. You only pay taxes when you sell it. And that can occur from a whole variety of reasons. Could be federal policy, could be a whole lot of things that come in. You can see, look at our last two kickers that occurred in 01, 03 and 07, 09. You can see that, you know, these were the peaks that drove those kickers. And here's the troughs as we're going into recession. You can see the capital gains revenue dropping way off. So I just to look at those components by the variation in our forecast of them, the general fund has a standard deviation. This is going back to 81, 83 when we first started doing our modern forecast system. It's about 7.2%. The non-corporate part, which is what the kicker's based on, is about 6.1. Corporate is about 30%. That's actually come down the last few years. So a huge variability. And the capital gains is 41%. So if you just look at general fund without capital gains, it's instead of being 7.2, it's 5.2. If you look at non-corporate without capital gains, instead of being 6.1, it's 4.5. So that's, again, a major source of the volatility in our forecasting system. This is my final slide, and it just looks at kind of what we would expect to happen in the next recession, given those standard deviations. Of course, we're not if we go way over, we end up triggering the kicker. But if we go way under is what I'm looking at. So I'm taking half that normally you'd expect about a 67%, you would be within one standard deviation. So I'm just looking at the tail, the lower tail when you're below the forecast. And if you apply that standard deviation, then we're talking about almost $1.3 billion for the coming biennium. And two standard deviations, which would be about 2.3% or 5% confidence interval for both tails, you're at $2.6 billion. So you can see the revenue shortfalls associated with that. And again, you know, this is one of the potential issues around tax reform is, one, to reduce that standard deviation of the projections, and two, to be better prepared for them through reserve fund policy. They're kind of two options. Or not necessarily, they're not, they can be very complementary. So that gives you a sense of kind of what our thinking is on some of the volatility issues, the different approaches. What we're going to be working with the work group on looking at some of these options. I've got Christine was going to come up and talk a little bit about the reconnection to the tax code at the AGI level. And Kyle was going to come up and talk a little bit about property taxes and the potential.
Christine, just before you do that, I know that we had a few people who wanted to weigh in that are up from Beaverton, and I was wanting to have them come up first. Just you have a short story to tell and kind of gets into why this reminds us why this is important. So coming up, guys.
Okay.
Always trying to put a human face on econometrics.
This thing on. Good morning.
Start off with your name. You don't have to get that close. That's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Right back here.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, my name is Doug Bundy, and I've been a part of the Beaverton School District since I was 6 years old, and I'm here requested to come and kind of put a human face on the teaching and the learning aspects of the system that we have and the volatility that has been so clearly elucidated already by Senator Haas. I've been a certified teacher for 18 years, and I currently have two children who attend the district. Through the eyes of my children, I see many of the wondrous things I remember from school as a child, like the commitment of a teacher who places a perfect book in the hands of an eager reader. Through the eyes of my children, I also see something I do not remember from my own childhood, a seemingly unending, unknowable economic landscape that creates chaos as it rides slightly behind the often dramatic swings of the larger economy. I'm here today to share two stories that I hope will give you some insight into the experience of teachers and students as we navigate this current reality. In the end, I want to ask for something, and I want you to say yes. The first story is about teaching. 3 years ago, reeling from the effects of the economic downturn, which rocked so many districts, and after several consecutive years of already brutal financial cutbacks, the Beaverton School District took extraordinary measures. Whole programs and hundreds of positions were cut. The district endeavored to save as many jobs as possible, but as Senator Haas has already pointed out, nearly 400 teachers were transferred or otherwise displaced. Not one of our 51 schools stayed intact. Many programs that were the hearts of schools and communities disappeared. Teachers found themselves teaching ages with whom they had no experience, and or teaching subject areas that they may have been licensed for, but had no business teaching. Students saw class sizes surge into the 50s in some cases in the high schools, and in the 40s at the elementary level. Although we are grateful for the recent efforts and additional funding from the state level, it has taken a local option levy and bond passage to bring about even the hope of a positive recovery from this catastrophe in Beaverton. It will take years to bring about healing in many places, and although many teachers have returned to much better fit positions, it will take many more years to try to regain momentum that has been lost during this time. Without the generous support of our community, we would still be sideways in the wind, watching as waves of our kids navigate a completely unacceptable experience. Although especially extreme, perhaps the most tragic thing, as you have already pointed out, is that this most recent financial episode is actually consistent with what I've experienced for most of my 18-year teaching career. Nearly every year, I've watched as principals tear their hair out from the stress of not knowing until the last minute how or if they can staff their buildings and support their students. Our students and community members look to us as we look vacantly at each other, unable to answer even simple questions about the directions of programs or teachers. The negative impacts on our students are palpable. As educators, we expend so much of our human capital trying to hold things together that we stand the chance of losing our ability to look ahead and innovate. We know that Beaverton is not the only district to have weathered very heavy seas over the past years. We also know that not every district is as fortunate as we are to be able to ask for and receive funds through a levy to help mitigate many of the negative impacts of the downturn. As fortunate as we are braced for the reality that unless this funding schema evolves, we may well be right back at this terrifying place when the levy runs out. The irony was not lost on me that our system has become so dysfunctional that we have reached back out to our local community to right the ship with local option levies, one of the very things that centralizing funding for schools via Measure 5 was supposed to avoid. The second story is about learning. My daughter Zoe is currently in fifth grade, and my son George is in first. The financial crisis happened when Zoe was in third grade. As a direct result of the cuts, she had 39 students in her math class. There was no time for questions, not enough bandwidth to make sure that kids were mastering material. Even the Herculean efforts of her teacher were not enough to soften the impact of the negative perceptions that emerged in the mind of my child that year. In an era where we are so vitally aware of the importance of encouraging young women in math, Zoe, like so many of her classmates, lost traction in this crucial subject. She cried every single morning. She hated school. It has taken the better part of 2 years to rebuild her confidence in math. Oh, sorry. She also has advantages that not every kid gets, like parents who are teachers and enough to eat. Not every kid is so lucky. 10 years ago, students eligible for free and reduced lunch made up about 20% of Beaverton's school population. Now, 10 years on, nearly 40% of our students qualify. One out of every 30 students in the district is homeless, and Beaverton has the highest number of homeless students in the state. Like so many districts, we are navigating the increasing needs and challenges that come from kids living in poverty. It's hard to imagine the impact that our society may feel years down the road as the fallout from this latest economic episode comes to bear on this already impacted population. Providing high-quality public education is a civic responsibility, and providing every child equal access to this education is an ethical imperative. Over the entirety of my teaching career, I've watched teachers and administrators double down and work harder, watched as community members let go of programs that give their children a reason to get up in the morning, watched as our children are afforded less opportunity and less consistency at the same time they are expected to do more academically, watched as more of our kids are struggling to navigate poverty, and watched as we decry our state of financial affairs but just can't seem to get it together. Watch with great consternation when we know that what we are doing as a system is not meeting the needs of our kids. Zoe and George are my children, and they are your children. I want you to know that educators are a determined group. We are relentless on ourselves when it comes to getting better. We lose sleep when our students stumble, but we never lose hope that what we do matters. To draw out, to educe, that's what education means, to bring out the potential inside every child. It is an aching, never-ending pursuit. This is what I'm asking for. I ask for your commitment to give us the financial stability we need so that we can move away from a state of constant triage. Much more than just keeping us afloat or moving our rankings up a few notches, this consistency will allow us to act and think anew, to innovate and provide every child with a future-ready education. We ask for a solution that, as much as possible, shields our kids from the unpredictable swings in funding that have unfortunately become the norm. I want to ask you if this solution will be in place by the time George reaches third grade. And I want you to say yes. Zoe and George are depending on us. Very soon, we will all be depending on them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Doug. It was very well done. What school do Zoe and George go to?
Raleigh Hills.
And you've been teaching for how long?
18 years. 13 at the high school level and 5 at the K-8 level.
Well, thanks for reminding us why this is important. We're doing our best, and we duly noted that you were not necessarily coming in saying, we just need more money.
No.
Which I think there's agreement here that all levels of education are underfunded, but what you said more strongly, I think, is you just need some stability.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Doug.
I have a question to Dr. Warner.
While we deal with that, Melissa Unger is here to come up. Go ahead.
The recession model you have? I mean, everybody here, sitting here in this room now at the diocese knows, you know, there's recessions and there's recessions. You said, are we prepared for the next recession? And that's a standard deviation recession you're talking about. Basically, I hate to say this, an average recession versus not another pitfall. Is that pretty correct? Because I'm looking at that $1.8 billion shortfall, and that kind of matches what Senator Devlin's saying, too. But I'm just wondering, what you put on the slide is a... It's based on the standard deviation and right. An average recession that unfortunately many of us have experienced, not another major pitfall like we just had.
Well,
Senator Boquist, I would say, and we do have some scenarios that we've looked at where we've seen a percentage as large as the Great Recession. And the old 103 was quite large, too, by historical standards. So that raises the issue, what's normal, what's the new normal, and that kind of thing. But the two standard deviations would be reflective of a Great Recession-type event. So we looked at one standard and then two standards. So I guess you could say the one standard deviation would be something that you're going to expect to occur 15% of the time. So that's probably a normal recession.
Right.
The two standard deviation would be a repeat of a great recession type event.
And the slide that you put up at the end of the last presentation is the standard one, right?
Well, I showed two. I had the one and the two. So I showed one standard deviation and two standard deviations.
Last page. It's always the last page, doom and gloom. You can go on, Mr. Chair.
I asked Melissa and Dan to come forward because they're 15, on this 17, issue 17, too, and they're considering some measures that would go before voters in 2016. So thanks for weighing in and engaging on this this issue. You heard the teacher before us, and we're all sort of in this together, and we'd love to find ways to stabilize our funding. Mostly, you know, half our budget goes to education. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Haas, and members of the committee for inviting us. For the record, I'm Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director for SEIU Local 503.
I'm Daniel Morris. I'm the research director for Our Oregon.
And I'm going to just kind of talk a little bit about what brings us to this conversation and not I appreciate Senator Haas inviting us. I mean, so SEIU Local 503 represents 55,000 members here in Oregon, and they kind of serve every element of the state, right? They kind of carry out the legislature's vision for our state, whether it's protecting kids and making sure that they're safe in their homes, serving seniors and people with disabilities or people with developmental disabilities to make sure that they can be independent in their homes, keeping open spaces open, keeping our roads safe. Our members throughout the state and every corner of the state really do kind of make our state go. And at the same time, they also are members of our communities. Their parents, as we just heard about our schools, their neighbors, and they care about their communities, keeping them safe and keeping them a place that is livable. And so when I tell you this, I start with this because that's really how we approach the conversation of tax reform. We really approach the conversation about what is needed to make sure that our members as people who serve the state and also as community members can really do the job that they're asked to do. And we completely agree with this kind of idea that we have a boom and bust system. And I think one of the challenges we see that is in the boom and bust system, it's not even during the boom years, it's not quite sufficient even. And so, you know, even this year where I feel like we're relatively stable, we're in a situation where as we talk about the budget, we're making trade-offs between employment-related daycare, which is a critical program for making sure that kids can get childcare, and third grade education, or we're making trade-offs between investing in higher education and investing in seniors. And those trade-offs are the trade-offs that we feel are not good for our communities. But during the bust years, it's horrible. And I think that, you know, we talked about the Beaverton case example, but over from 2008 to 2013, 3,386 teachers statewide were laid off. So you look at Beaverton and the 400, but if you really look statewide, it's even more dramatic. And I think that what Senator Haas referred to as just kind of the impact of that to the teachers and to the kids is very real, and how many of those people will never come back to that profession. We see that in the same in state workforce, where folks who had this as the vision for what they wanted to do, whether it's go be a caseworker or a DHS, but with layoffs weren't able to do that. These are college-educated folks who are able to go find something else, and we lose their passion and their efforts for the rest of the state time. And so as we look at the boom and bust years, I mean, I think Senator Haas talked a lot about the general fund. But even when you look at all revenues, not just the general fund, we find ourselves to be highly volatile. And this is it's a huge problem for how do we plan and make sure that we stabilize state services. And I think, as you all know, and as we talked about, one of the states that's the most volatile here is in Alaska, because they bring in revenues oddly off, you know, kind of their natural resources. So that's a lot different than how we do it. But even when you look at all revenues, we find ourselves to be one of the most volatile in the country. And, you know, as has already been talked about today, that has a lot to do with a personal income tax, and the kicker is a piece of that problem. And so we really do believe that one piece of this problem is to look at how we stabilize the system. But we also do believe that it has to include more revenues to make sure that we can actually move our state forward and make sure that people have the services that they rely on, and have good schools and good and safe roads and everything that they need. And, you know, one of the conversations that comes up a lot in this is kind of what would voters support? And I think we really think it's an important piece of the conversation, not just to talk about what voters would support, but it's really about what voters can afford. And so, you know, we talked it was just discussed kind of a little bit about our regressivity as a tax system, and we are one of the most progressive in the country. And this came out from that recent report. You might have seen the headlines that said we're one of the more progressive in the country. This is kind of how we are the most progressive. We're one of the least regressive is actually the way we should say it. So we are one of the most progressive, but really we are one of the least regressive because we are still technically regressive. And I think that we still see that the bottom 20% of people are still paying more of a percent in their income in taxes than the top 1% or any other group of folks. And the impact of that is that people really do feel like they can't afford anything else. I think we were just talking about the other day about how bond measures sometimes are going down, even though people will say they support those services. And people can't really say that, you know, a sales tax is a lot about taxing them. And I think it's not just about like, oh, I don't support taxes. It's really about they can't afford anymore. And so as we look at our membership, which is a diverse group of members who are, you know, kind of on average make between $20,000 to $55,000 a year, and they think about what they can afford for their families. They really can't afford anymore. And so I think that the conversation we like to have around taxes is not just about how do we stabilize, but how do we stabilize in a way where we're acknowledging where Oregonians are at. And how do we stabilize in a way where we understand that we can't ask folks who aren't actually making any more money but actually seeing a decline in their incomes to put more money into the system? And so that really does bring us to the conversation about corporate taxes. And two independent economic reports, one by Ernst & Young for the Council on State Taxation and one by the Anderson Economic Group, really do estimate both that that Oregon is in 50th place in the effective business tax rate, and that even if we increase our taxes by $2 billion a year, we'd still be below Idaho. And so these are not kind of left-leaning research groups. And so this is, for us, a really big piece of the conversation on tax reform is we do believe we need to stabilize it. We do think that by adding additional taxes into the system, a stabilized tax system into the system, that we can help do that. But we also don't think that it can just be a conversation about how do Oregonians pay, how do more people pay, and not really address this issue of us being 50th in the country on corporate taxes. And, you know, I think this is a final graph, is that just kind of our personal income tax collection over the years has gone up while corporate taxes have really stayed stable. And I think that that is just another way to look at how this all kind of comes together. And so as we look at tax reform, and we're excited to be a part of all the conversations you guys are going to be having this session, this is really how we address the conversation. We do believe that stability is a big part of this, and we think that the moves that we've made to build up the rainy day fund slowly over the last 10 years have been good, and we need to continue to look for ways to do that. We believe that adequacy is a big piece of this, and how do we make sure we can provide the services that Oregonians rely on? And then we really do think that we need to make sure that we are addressing the issue of us being 50th in the country on corporate taxes, and make sure as we talk about what voters would support, we understand that a lot of that has to do with what voters could afford. So we can answer any questions, and Daniel really is the expert on the slide, so if there's any specific questions, I want to be very clear, he's the person that has to answer them.
Well, it's a really interesting, I mean, you've raised some philosophical questions in my mind. What will voters support versus what can they afford, and is progressivity at the expense of more revenue fair trade? And so thank you for your presentation. Any questions?
I,
I just have an observation.
One second, Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the graph with the corporate line being flat and the personal, that slide there. I think we have to be conscious, though, in the corporate world, a lot of those are sub-S's or shareholders, and that income gets shifted to the upper line, which is the personal income tax. So I just wanted to point that out so it doesn't look like people that are involved in corporations are not paying taxes. It's just they get shifted to the personal income line.
Senator Buckley.
Thank you for the presentation. And having gone through the dungeon routine 2 years ago, and your union was part of the dungeon routine too, whether we agree or disagree, having the discussion, but I think two key points that I think there's real agreement on, and that's one of the problems that we have, I think, in my observation of a decade here, Mr. Chair, of not solving the problem, and that is as you read it, you're the state employee union, and so you're impacted by other funds. And the volatility in there is, I mean, we're talking a 25% swing, mm-hmm. Okay? Now, that's real people, when you're losing and moving people. And so, and then we always have this habit, unfortunately, we saw this last session, is that, well, that's a fee and that's not a tax. And so it's not part of the overall discussion. And that's the problem here of, you know, not only volatility. You're impacted. I mean, if people aren't paying the fee, then they're cutting your people and they're going, right? And the other thing that, you know, I want to jump on here, and everybody in the committee can throw stones at me afterwards, this is fine, but I'm with you. I mean, we're really addressing this as the least regressive system. I mean, Oregon has a regressive system. You know, if you're the person that's at the bottom, that's the working poor or the poor, I mean, they're looking at us and saying, you're just giving lip service to this thing. And that's, in you know, my district. I mean, I'm in this district of gerrymandering in which, you know, I'm in the highest unemployment rates and I'm in the lowest wage jobs that are out there. And so, I mean, we need, and I agree with the chair, I mean, we need to look at a holistic way to make this work better. And then once we figure out make to work better, then I'm into the discussion, and I'm not opposed to it. I'm just, and not necessarily for it. Then we're into the discussions. If we make the system better, fairer, and across the board, then the question is, what is the need? And that's, you know, the kind of the steps of going there. But I'm with you with the regressive and how do we fix the other funds thing. So, and yeah. I don't have a solution, by the way. I tried two sessions ago. Got beat the daylight beat out of me. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, I agree, Senator Boquist, with the same. We're not, when I saw that headline too, it wasn't that we're one of the most fair. It was that we're not as unfair as folks. It's not a snappy headline. And it would have gone down the side of the page.
Right.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
We look forward to engaging with you as we both move down these tracks. So now let's go to Christine.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm Christine Barniak from the Legislative Revenue Office. In your OLIS, there is a page that is basically a flow chart from the adjusted gross incomes down to the amount that's actually taxed in Oregon, Oregon taxable income. And there's a process that tax income goes through before becoming taxable. The largest part of that process would be the deductions that are taken from the AGI before they become taxable, and that they total $15.9 billion in a year, in the most recent tax year available, 2012. The additions are often things that the federal government does not tax, but Oregon does tax. So there's a necessity to add some components of income back for some people. And then there are things that Oregon does not tax that the federal government does tax. And so result in a subtraction prior to becoming taxable income. And then you have your deductions that you could take relative to your filing status, or maybe Schedule A status if you've deducted things from your income there. But the idea would be that this taxable income is $70.8 billion, and it results in $5,264 million, or $5.3 billion in revenue for the state. And if you avoided all of the changes, including the additions, subtractions, deductions, and tax credits, and taxed directly just on federal adjusted gross income, it would result in obviously some winners and losers in the system, but potentially it would be taxing a broader base. And the tax rate, effective tax rate on federal adjusted gross income would only have to be 5.7% to get the revenue of $5.3 billion that we get from the current system. So that would be one of the avenues that might be available to change the tax system. But with that, unless there are any questions, I...
Christina, do you have a question? Since he's coming back. You heard my question earlier, and I'd asked Paul about that. Is this what, you know, the viewing audience out there that are in the tax camp or whatever kind of call a flat tax? And the number you gave us is just the single number, right? Is if we just went through an adjusted gross income and a flat tax, pretty much a flat tax, the one rate it would be is
5.7%.
Right. And of course, there would be an option, as Mr. Warner said, to have like a two-tier, but that's... If you went to match what they traditionally call the flat, I know you economists don't call it flat tax, but I'm talking about people in the camera back there, okay? Is it right at 6% then?
Yes.
So, thanks. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions?
Okay, thank you.
Kyle?
Yeah, I have a presentation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And as Paul alluded to earlier, there's some components of the property tax system that have been set by voter initiative in the past 20 years or so that changes the dynamic and the way any tax reform for the property tax system would be made. So I wanted to briefly just touch on those to give some explanation of what is in the Constitution and what is just in statute, just to kind of frame the discussion. On OLIS, I have just a few slides to kind of go through. It's called Property Tax Reform. So the first slide, I just wanted to break up the components of the property tax law. So on the left, you have what's in the Oregon Constitution. So without going into too much detail, two voter initiatives really set the stage for how the property tax system is currently administered. You have Measure 5 from back in 1990, which placed limits, overall limits, taxing limits for the two types of districts, education-related districts and then general government-related districts. And the second component was Measure 50, passed more recently in 97, that did two things. It changed the property tax system from a levy-based one to one on rate-based, and then also made this adjustment where we now have a real market value and also a maximum assessed value of property. And the idea being there was to add some stability to the property tax system. Maximum assessed value is limited in growth of 3% per year. And that's why you've seen there's less volatility in property tax since that change, because you do have this limit on growth. But both of those things are in the Constitution. Included in those are such things related to merging and dividing districts. One thing that gets discussed quite a bit is local option levies, and these are levies that local districts, it goes out to voters, and if they support them, they can be in place for up to 5 years, and you can have an additional property tax levy supporting a district. It could be a school, county, city, and so on. And there are those are limited to 5 year in duration. And bond levies, somewhat similar, only they're not subject to Measure 5 compression, are limited to 10 years or the useful life of the capital project. And both of those things are also in the Constitution. Things that are not that I have labeled as just statute provisions include such things. It's you can think the big triggers are special assessments and exemptions. So those can be adjusted at statute change for the most part. Some of the laws related to urban renewal, and then also property tax relief, which can be a big one. We don't have much property tax relief anymore. Most of the programs, we had two programs that were phased out in, I think it was the late 70s or the mid-80s and the early 90s. What remains is the senior disabled deferral program, and there's also elderly rental assistance. But if there was some need to place those in, that could be done outside of the Constitution. I also put on their central assessment provisions, but I won't go into detail on that. I think we're covering those, but I didn't want to break the record of mentioning it each day. And then the last one is the state property tax. And the last time we had a state property tax was back in 1940, and it was phased out, or began to be phased out in 1929 with the implementation of the personal income tax, which was set to basically capture those revenues.
Senator Boquist.
State property tax?
Yes.
You could levy a state property tax in statute.
Are you getting some ideas?
Mr. Chair, we Republicans have said that we're open to discussion, and we agree. We're open to having broad discussions to everything to see, you know, where we're going. But I mean, I had not even, that's like a new one. I don't think I've ever heard that one in any of the discussions we've had.
Well, it's a good thing you didn't know that back when you were coming up with the grand bargain.
Let's not use that terminology.
And I should put it out there. None of these are, I don't mean to be suggestive in any way. Of course, LRO.
You have the albatross. You're done.
I do have up there just a slide on kind of the goal of tax reform. I'd plug a report that LRO did a few years ago related to horizontal equity. It was released in 2010 that discussed, it's mostly how Measure 50 has affected horizontal equity and how you can have properties that are worth the same in real market value terms but are taxed vastly different based upon their growth since Measure 50 came into being. And there's been a number of reports, not just the one from LRO, that's been put out to discuss that issue, and it's especially can be problematic in areas where you've seen large amounts of growth in the last 15, 20 years, especially in different pockets of maybe urban areas. But a lot of times what gets discussed under property tax reform is one of the, I think most people would argue, the good things of property tax is stability. Is the property tax system does have a pretty good amount of stability. Revenues definitely do move with the overall climate. We never saw revenues decrease, but you definitely saw a slowing in the positive year-over-year increase in the most recent recession. But as we've come back out of that, we've seen revenues overall in post figures moving back up to their 10, 15-year trend. And so then the last slide, I just had some general proposals, and these are things that have just been discussed. Once again, don't want to suggest anything. They're just been ones that have been out there and discussed. Some are specific to Oregon's system, and then also property tax reform is discussed nationally and even globally. It's one of those taxes that it has a lot of positive administration things related from administering it, but like any tax, there's a number of people that dislike it for numerous reasons. So the general proposals are, of course, RMV, MAV changes. These would be constitutional. Circuit breakers. They're also, you may know this as like a homestead exemption. So any change, sometimes you can add in a circuit breaker that may tie the property tax to the income. That is one of the downsides of it, is ability to pay may not necessarily be, it's not built into the property tax system. So there is a correlation certainly between the value of the property that an individual owns with their overall wealth, but that doesn't mean on a especially year over year basis, whether they have the income to make that payment, certainly. And that's where circuit breakers can come into effect. And then I the last one I had in there is just land value taxation. There's definitely a small group of individuals that are always discussing the positives of land value taxation, but that is where you tax only the land and not the improvements. But it's, I just wanted to make the committee aware of it. It is a reform proposal often discussed.
Mm-hmm. And we discussed some of these concepts that are in our work group on reform, particularly the homestead exemptions, make some other change, circuit breaker. And some of those not necessarily for revenue raising, but for that elusive equity that we're trying to find in our system. And in the case of property taxes, just to straighten things out so you don't have the situation that Dr. Warner referred to, where somebody's living across the street from in the same house, same kind of house, paying vastly different bills.
Sure. But that concludes what I have, Mr. Chair. So if there's any questions.
Any questions for Kyle on property taxes?
I do have a follow-up to Senator
Bertrand's
question for Paul and them later. It'd be very interesting to look at, you know, since we switched over to school funding specifically, you know, because, I mean, can't do everything, and we moved from a property, mostly property tax was paying for schools. We changed the law, and now we've switched over. More than curious in a comparison to see, is in a, at least in a broad scope, what would be the property tax rate in theory if we were still funding schools at present value today, even though I think we all agree in one manner or the other they're not funded properly. But what would those property tax rates be out there?
Yeah.
I mean, if we were looking out in, you know, my county, like we'll pick Polk, who's in trouble, or pick Washington County, what would the property tax rate if they were still paying the original load pre-Measure 54750, because, you know, we all know that's a huge shift. I mean, the biggest portion of our budget now is education, and that shift has come from property tax not paying it.
Right.
I think it was inevitable that you would have had some sort of change from voters or from the legislature, because exactly what Kyle just said, it wasn't tied to people's ability to pay. And
right.
I think that's, and we discussed many times before that the measure was passed not by conservative parts of Red Oregon. It was Multnomah County.
Yeah, right.
And those housing values were going up, far outstripping people's income. So,
Mr. Chair, one thing I would add too that I think is sometimes overlooked, but a big factor in the Measure 5 decision was that in the 1979, the same time the kicker was established, there's a major property tax relief program that was established that affected most property taxpayers and constituted a big chunk of the general fund. So it was distributed out and to offset a lot of the effects of the property tax. One of the major areas that was cut during what was then almost a Great Recession, the Great Recession I in the early 80s, was that program. So that, in effect, exposed people a lot more to those property tax rates without the benefit of overall state relief program, a much, much smaller one than they had earlier.
Our predecessors did it, and then we paid for it.
Many thanks to all of you for indulging me and indulging the committee on this. I hope that this is sort of planted a seed so that as we move forward through the session, we'll not only try to make some changes here to stabilize things, but keep this sort of in planted in our mind as we pass other or consider other legislation before us. Balance is the key here. Stable funding is the key. And whatever we do, it's going to be hard. But if you think that's hard, you have no idea how hard it was to balance those rocks just like that to get them. So, anyway, thank you all. Unless we have any further business before us, we are adjourned. We are adjourned.